Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Oh, it's a goal. Who got the assist? Who got the assist?
Hello, so it's still pre-season, but things are getting close now as we're 3 weeks to go to that all-consuming Game Week 1 kickoff. We're continuing our pre-season content today following the excellent podcast with Neil Murray last time out. It's worth flicking back to that if you can on the Unwritten Rules of FPL. Total joy to record. And we're here with the first of two blockbuster analysis pods of all 20 Premier League teams. Of course, you'll be very happy to hear that it's not just me doing this. I'm joined today, as always, by the slap in the face and admonishment to pull yourself together, man, to my fuzzy cuddle. It will all be okay in Nick. Are you all right, mate?
Yeah, not bad, thank you. Yes, not just yourself doing a sort of solid monologue going through all 10 teams. New listeners, special hello. Go back to our Unwritten Rules pod and also our intro pod if you're interested to find out more about who we are, regular listeners. As always, unbelievable support. Happy to have you on board. We've done some recent work as well on Talisman Theory from Tom and Psychology Corner staff and overmanagement. Plenty of prospects in the prospects as well. So lots of WGTA content to get stuck into if you're at a loose end. This week, it's the start of our analysis of the 20 teams, starting with Arsenal all the way to Liverpool today. And yeah, just to say who we are Who Got The Assist. You can find us on Twitter at WGTA_FPL, online at whogottheassist.com.
Listen to us and subscribe to us via any good or bad pod site out there, such as Spotify, SoundCloud, iTunes, wherever you'd like. So today, obviously, is teams, and we'll go through every team and every player of interest we possibly can. Of course, we'll naturally miss some, so sorry for that if you're the kind of person who's a massive fan of Jurgen Lacadia, for example. We're going to start with team data and go down to players. No definitive answers, just data. These are, of course, long podcasts. I'm going to edit it down as far as I possibly can. I've done a lot of research and hopefully this can be really, really useful. Unfortunately, we've got to start with Arsenal here. I might let you go first, actually.
So yeah, if we're going to talk about Arsenal, let's talk about their season last year. And it was kind of a mixed bag, wasn't it, for them? It wasn't a great season, but particularly I was actually surprised really by their struggles in the defence more than the attack. And the defence was pretty damn poor, wasn't it, last year? Only 8 clean sheets, which was sort of the joint 8th worst in the league. They were 9th best for goals conceded in comparison with 51. And historically, this is actually very unusual for Arsenal, as their lowest clean sheets by 5 since 2011-12. So historically, they've always been pretty solid. They've had sort of 13 or so clean sheets. I think it was a couple of seasons ago, they had 18 as well, when Hector Bellerin scored 172 points. That was back in 15-16. Wasn't a great season for them, but the attack actually is more interesting. When you look at the Arsenal players, it's the forward line that most interests us compared to the defence in the midfield. What do you think about your club there then, Tom?
Oh, God. Commence rant. So as a fan, I could actually go on a big rant here. But for me, I think the key fact is that I've never had that moment with Emery, like an epiphany where I say, yeah, I know where you're going here, Unai. It was very much a case for him, I think, of making oddball side that he inherited with elements of, you know, the pragmatism that he has to fill the team most weeks. But decisions like Ozil on the wing and Guendouzi being given the creative role perhaps meant that pragmatism was outweighed by a lack of other options. And we've got a good start versus Newcastle and Burnley, so they may be being overlooked. I'm happier to leave us, really, Nick, to our good run between game weeks 5 and 16. We're only playing Man United in game week 7 in a run that takes in home matches against Villa, Bournemouth and Brighton. Like things, you mentioned last year, it was obviously not the finish we wanted, but don't forget in the beginning we had a 20 match unbeaten run but the utter collapse at the end of the season, which we're remembering, it left a sour taste in mouths, and those stats were all okay. Like, we were actually the only team in the top six away who conceded more than did at home, for example. So clean sheets, yeah, is a real worry, and it's not looking good back there at all, is it?
Yeah, I think from a club perspective, obviously, there are a number of concerns. As an Arsenal fan, obviously, you're very concerned about what's happening at the moment with the club, what the direction the club is going with, and what the transfer window will bring in terms of any new signings, if anyone does join or what happens. But I think I look at Arsenal these days, and I think a lot of our listeners do, from a pure FPL perspective. And I think from an FPL perspective, if we look at the defence, because I think the offence actually was very strong. They were the third highest in the league with 73 goals, so just behind City and Liverpool. But from the defence, obviously, we mentioned they didn't do very well last season, but could it have potentially just been a blip? Can they improve? They've obviously got some issues in the back line, likes of Koscielny had a falling out. Is that just a scratch, just a flesh wound maybe in terms of their defensive barrier? They've got potentially Holding coming in. 4.5 million nailed on defender. That's quite exciting for managers from an FPL perspective to get a nailed on 4.5 central defender at Arsenal. And then they've got Leno, of course, Bernd Leno, not Jay Leno, in goal. And he's 5 million. And yeah, actually, when you compare him to the other goalkeepers at 5 million, you've got the likes of Foster, you've got Dubravka at the same price. You kind of look at Arsenal goalkeeper 5 million. Interesting, that's quite good value for money, isn't it, compared to some of the other goalkeepers out there?
No, I think there's one good stat on this, which is Leno, 5 errors leading to goal last season. Actually, we won the errors leading to goal stat last season with 13, which is more than the likes of Fulham, who conceded 30 more goals than we did. And you know what's really worrying, Nick? That's actually an improvement on last season, where we made a ridiculous 15 errors leading to goal. Leno is the prime culprit for this. The perfect heir to Cech. And I actually looked into these numbers, and I found that Cech and Leno are numbers 1-2 goalkeepers making errors leading to goal ever. Well, since their first stats begin in 2011-12. So, I think our back line's really losing stuff. I even prefer like the likes of Fabianski to Leno at this point. And the save percentage was pretty decent, but apart from that, yeah, I'm not too interested. I mean, most of the defence, apart from Stuart Holding and maybe Ainsley Maitland-Niles, who Adam Pritchard loves, belong in a skip, the likes of Mustafi. Definitely not. Kolasinac is probably one that was worth mentioning quickly. I mean, many of us fell for him in double game week last year. He had a lower number of crosses than the likes of Matt Lowton and Gaetan Bonk. But I guess he had XGI in his favour. So he's just outside of the top 10 for defenders, achieving the 5.06 he was expected to get, basically. He created 10 big chances, the same as like Luiz and Pereira, who are 6.0. But equally, he was just such a letdown for many people. I think that's going to be, for 5.5, too much money. And then he's obviously got Kieran Tierney potentially coming in as well. Averages of 6 assists per season in the SPL. Like, could that mean that Kolasinac is like condemned to the UEL? Who knows?
Yeah, I think obviously Kolasinac is one of the players I owned at the close season. He was completely terrible for me. So 0 points and 1 point despite double game weeks. But yeah, I think my last point, I guess, on the defence is I still feel like they were a little bit unlucky in terms of their clean sheet volumes. For instance, they only conceded 2 extra goals compared to Crystal Palace, but Crystal Palace managed 12 clean sheets compared to Arsenal's 8 clean sheets. So, you know, it's quite a small difference between that 8 clean sheet and 12 clean sheets in terms of FPL points, but in terms of actual goals, it's very little.
Yeah, I know what you mean there, but on that, I think there is one person who I would like the look of, which is fashionista, arc vegan, and perpetual mob annoyer, Hector Bellerin. He only played 17 games last season and contributed 5 assists. And I think over the last 3 seasons, he's averaged 141 points per year, including that kind of high score season that you indexed. Generally good for about 5 assists. And he was basically an auxiliary winger. In 2017-18, he was second for big chances created with 10. So I think that, you know, at 5.5 Bellerin, once he's back in the team and integrated with the squad, he could be one to watch, especially if he drops down to, you know, 5.4, 5.3, something like that.
Yeah, definitely. I think he perhaps is the pick of the bunch in terms of that back line. So he's 5.5, so a little bit more expensive than some of the other assets, but yeah, definitely got the highest potential and highest point ceiling out of all of them.
In the midfield, you've got the likes of Ozil and Mkhitaryan making $350,000 each week. Yeah, no, let's ignore that. And in a football sense, I rate the likes of Iwobi, who was the highest Arsenal point scorer in midfield last season, look it up. I rate Torreira, who's 5.0, and Guendouzi in 4.5, and have glimpsed a possible doozy future in the Football Manager when he's a really, really good player and said he expects to play a bit more next season. It comes to something really, doesn't it, when I'm recommending a 4.5 midfielder as the only midfield option for Arsenal. Yeah. And, you know, we've got Zaha, Ceballos, Fraser, all of these people being linked. And obviously by the time this pod comes out, it's going to be completely outdated because someone's going to come in. But yeah, I think it's all about the strikers, isn't it? It's all Aubameyang versus Lacazette.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's quite telling that despite the forward line being where all the money's tied up for Arsenal, with Aubameyang costing 11 million, Lacazette costing 9.5 million, that they were still actually the two best value players in the Arsenal team as per the value metrics that we've done. And yeah, Aubameyang costs 11 million, as I said, Laka 9.5 million. You know, they were the source for all the goals, all the attacks from Arsenal. You know, they're your most dangerous assets by far. I think it's quite interesting that Aubameyang actually managed to score more than double than all the midfield picks. And with the opening fixtures of Newcastle away and Burnley at home, I really think they are actually flying under the radar in terms of a differential pick. Aubameyang was a joint top scorer last season in the league. He had a ridiculous 36 big chances last season, so he really should have put away a few more. But actually his goal conversion rate wasn't that bad, all things considering, with which was 23.4%, and that was only beaten by Glenn Murray in terms of active forwards.
Yeah, certainly. Aubameyang, I absolutely hated last season because I backed him in such a big degree. As you remember, Nick, coming in game week one, I went with Aubameyang over Kun Aguero. Yeah, that worked out well. And it's a curiosity in and of itself, isn't it? Like, you know, the big chances number that you cited. Like, looking into it a bit more, he overshot his XG to begin with, fueled by those two braces off the bench, and undershot it in the end. So the season was really a game of two halves. I'm not going to go into that too much. It creates a how long is a piece of string argument. But that might be a case, perhaps, to get him in early because he was so good earlier on. He was 4 for shots in the box from the strikers, but really accurate with those shots. Your conversion rate, 41% of all shots were on target. Laka only had 63 shots in the box for comparison. Well, Aubameyang will always get the chance. He's got that kind of athletic, muscular movement to get there. It's just those, you know, 23 missed big chances last season, an astonishing 64% miss rate for those high XG moments. So Vardy in comparison, 33 big chances, 17 missed, so 49% in comparison. Laka is really the beta to Alba's alpha. Like, it's a good thing he costs 1.5 million less. Like, Alba beats him across all measures. It's just whether we really want to look at Alba and think, oh, okay, he's worth it. Got a really good run from game week 5 or 6 onwards, but I think he could be there. And be our kind of holy hand grenade that we throw into our teams to make things better after initial slump. But it comes to something really when all I can really recommend is Guendouzi as your second choice, 4.5 after Dion Donker from the Arsenal team. I think you can happily just leave them for the time being and then see what happens. Like, obviously, there's a good first few fixtures, but I don't think I'm really interested in them at all. Nick, are you interested in anybody from Arsenal?
At the moment, I don't have any Arsenal coverage in my team. If it's clear that Holding's going to be nailed down, I might consider him as perhaps as a fifth defender in my team. The spend sort of 0.5 more than Ben Gibson to get Rob Holding a nailed on Arsenal defender. It might be tempting for when the fixtures change. You know, I might be tempted to play him against the likes of Burnley at home in game week 2, and it gives a really strong rotation pick. So he would be the one that I would be thinking about personally. However, I think from an FPL perspective, it is the forward line. Aubameyang, as you said, is the alpha, Laka's the beta. But, you know, Laka is still a really good option, I think, in terms of an FPL asset. He wasn't that far behind Aubameyang, really, in terms of the underlying stats. It's just, it was unfortunate, really, that he just didn't convert as many. He only scored 13 goals compared to Aubameyang's 22, which was sort of the big, most important metric of them all. But I still think Laka, you know, if you want to get an Arsenal player and you're desperate for some reason, you can't afford Aubameyang, then Lacazette would definitely work as a good coverage.
Yeah, exactly. The old 1-2 there. Okay, let's move on to the next team. It's Aston Villa. So Villa then, things seem to have really changed when Dean Smith came in there last year. Like, many Villa fans credit his impact on the team as a key conduit to promotion. They were pretty attacking last year. 701 attempts, 343 in the box, 86 goals scored, 64 conceded though. That was the same as 21st place Millwall and 18th place Wigan. 1.67 goals per game, 1.31 conceded, and they scored more at home. Worryingly conceded more at home as well. So 1.33 they conceded at home on average per game versus 1.08. After Spurs and game week one, it's actually not too bad. Like, the next four comprise three home games, Bournemouth, Everton and West Ham. But I'm still sceptical. I'm leaning a bit on Adam Hopcroft here. Like, there's a lot of turnover of the squad, but we've assertively been told on Twitter, haven't we, Nick? When Nick caused the scene saying that Villa have a new Fulham.
Don't think that was me.
We definitely aren't. And there's a good point from a football perspective, say that it's a blend of purchases, re-signing the likes of El Ghazi and Mings, young players with potential and target. Lucy Hynett was very happy with that money paid for him. Shut up Wesley and Concert and Trezeguet as well. Just today, the Egyptian has seems to have signed. Huge support from them, of course, but I really think it's still watch and wait with them. Is that about right?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think it's worth diving in and loading up on Villa players at all, to be honest. I mean, like I said, we talked about Villa perhaps doing a repeat Fulham, though there's obviously been scathing criticism from people in regards to that idea, and also an interesting article by Martin Loris from Who Scored on The Guardian, who highlighted the difference between Fulham's spewing of money on deadline day, where they signed five players, versus Aston Villa's more thought-out purchases. But, you know, I mean, obviously, Mings and Target, they weren't fitting in at Bournemouth and Southampton. So those guys are coming in, sort of second-string defenders from those clubs to Villa. You know, the links with Tom Heaton in goal, I think he would be a fantastic signing if they are able to secure him as a goalkeeper. Perhaps a potential way in if you're interested in covering Aston Villa. But, yeah, with their opening fixtures, Spurs away, we'll see how they get on and assess from there. Especially in terms of the defence. Moving forward to the midfield, it's kind of this whole McGinn-Grealish sort of debate, and McGinn got the cheaper price despite scoring more goals and assists in the Championship. But Grealish is obviously the famous name and perhaps the more exciting option. I know you in your prospects, Tom, you sort of compared him to how Sessegnon and Anthony Knockaert got on in the Championship, both scoring 15 compared to Grealish only scoring 6. And both of those players really struggled in the Premier League in their opening season.
Admittedly, from the voice of Villa fans, like, they see Grealish as being their talisman for obvious reasons, and think that he actually is more suited to the Premier League than he was to the Championship, because he just used to get cut down by defenders straight away. Whereas it may be that he gets more space. 15 goals and 16 assists career, 4 goals and 7 assists last season, his best returns ever. Like, you've got to take that with a pinch of salt and to kind of see what happens with him rather than buying him in. I suspect that's not going to hurt you too much as well, because I think it will only be like kind of diehard Villa fans who have him in from day one. Created 76 chances last season, despite limited game time. Injury is another worry with him, and took 24 shots in the box. So he's basically like a beta version of James Maddison. He creates a lot and takes a lot of shots. 120 points, I think I said, in the perspective of the prospects, or he is what I'm expecting. And Adam Hopcroft said to me as well that he expects that he may step up to take pens as the club captain. And there's a few other options as well. And there's Hurrahain. I know him from Football Manager very, very well. He's a box-to-box midfielder, 6 goals, 8 assists last season. Takes a lot of shots from outside the box. 67 of his 85 shots, 78% were from there. Good on set piece as well. And he performed 51 key passes last season. You've got Hota from Birmingham, who has scored 164 points last season. It's pretty decent. 3 goals and 11 assists. And McGinn as well, 7 goals and 9 assists. But a yellow card machine, 14. So maybe Hurrahan at 6.0 may be a good counterpart to Grealish as well. It's just a case of seeing who emerges. Play attacking football under Dean Smith, and there may be a time when Villa players do come into the equation.
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot depends on sort of Wesley, I guess. He's the sort of 6 million option in the front line. He's either going to be the holy hand grenade in the Villa attack or just be a dead parrot. We'll have to see for now. But in the Jupiler Pro League in Belgium, sort of 76 appearances, 19 goals, 13 assists. It's not amazing stats, but they're just going to have to hope that the 22-year-old can do what Benteke did for them historically. I mean, they signed him for 22 million, and Dean Smith's been very positive about Wesley. He's got that little bit of panache and scores all kinds of goals from outside the box, 2-yard tap-ins. He's got everything about him. So I think Dean Smith's obviously a huge fan of Wesley, but I think Villa's success will ride quite heavily on whether he can deliver in the Premier League or not next season.
Yeah, certainly. And you know, up front, that void that he's got to fill, like Tammy Abraham repeating his smash the Championship shtick, previously seen at Bristol City, 25 goals on all he scored. As you mentioned, Benteke was the last man Aston Villa signed from the Belgian League, which meant we didn't know prospects because it is the Belgian League, same with Trussard at Brighton. But Benteke in his first season got 19 goals and got 4 assists in 2012-13. In the Premier League. So if the circumstances are the same and he's got that ability. Tyrone Mings also said that he's got his work cut out, in inverted commas, keeping up with the muscular Brazilian in training. There may be something there. At 6.0, that may offer an option, but it's one to watch and wait. We don't want to Fecho Lavash straight away and go with Villa. I think the word here, if we're asking, are we interested in them, is to watch and wait, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So are you happy to move on to Brighton then, Tom?
Yes.
Okay, so yeah, moving on to Brighton, sort of another club that perhaps we're not heavily loading on at this moment in time. Obviously, they've sacked their manager, Chris Hughton, and have brought in Graham Potter from Swansea. So we're looking to see what magic he's going to weave over the course of the season. I think Brighton last season, they really did struggle, and they were very close actually to relegation in the end. They conceded 60 goals, which is sort of seventh worst in the league. And in terms of their goal attacking output, it was absolutely terrible. They were second lowest for goal attempts of 371, and with only 35 goals, that was the worst for all clubs that didn't get relegated. There really was very little attacking output. They relied quite heavily on Glenn Murray and also Shane Duffy, surprisingly, for the goals, didn't they?
I think with Brighton as well, with Burnley, we're going to speak about later on, I think it's a case of throwing away the last season and starting afresh. I mean, with Potter, it's crucial that he does something very quickly there. But at Swansea, we may have some clues to the sort of manager he's going to be. Like, despite finishing 10th last season in the Championship, they were 7th for shots on target, more than eventually promoted Sheffield United, actually. And he's a very competent manager, it seems, Potter. He's gone a long way round, obviously, to Swansea last season were in absolute dire straits. So they received £40 million plus in revenues, but only spent £5 million on young prospects like Berchan Chelena from Man City and Joel Lasoro, both very young players. And he can develop players as well. So the likes of Ollie McBurney came on leaps and bounds. That guy scored 22 goals. Unfortunately, I find it objectively very hard to get excited about Brighton, despite the okay start of Watford, West Ham, Southampton, City and Burnley. As you mentioned, 60 goals conceded last year, 54 the year before. So they're always going to be those perennial strugglers. And Swansea last year, actually, were very poor at defending set pieces and aerial balls. So maybe Dunk and Duffy are going to be those guys who are going to sort it out. Well, Dunk maybe, if who knows if he's going to go to Leicester or not, probably not. And Duffy definitely are both going to be there. Duffy was third on clearances, blocks, interceptions last year, which shows how important he is in repelling attacks from that defence. And Dunk also there, 277 in the top 10. But Matt Ryan has been appearing in a lot of teams recently because of the King and Air thing going on with Button. So I guess it's a good place to start.
Yeah, definitely. I think Ryan really combines quite well with Button for sort of 4.5 million, sort of 4.0 million goalkeeper. Brighton, obviously, as I mentioned, are sort of a team that sort of had a lot of goal attempts against them. So plenty of opportunities there for saves for Ryan. He's got two, you know, very important beaters in front of him, Dunk and Duffy. If they lose Dunk, then it does remain a little bit of a concern for Potter and Brighton because of obviously, you know, just sort of backup option, Balogun not being particularly impressive. I think out of the sort of 4.5 million goalkeepers out there, Ryan is certainly a really good choice if you're looking for sort of a value goalkeeper.
Yeah, certainly. He's an option. I did have a look at the goalkeeping stats, which is a road less travelled by many. And he actually conceded 3 more goals than he was expected to last season. Whoops. 98 saves as well. All right. Yeah, but not great. 6 clean sheets makes me really worry for Ryan. Like, as you mentioned, Dunk, if it's not him, then Clark from Pompey, a new signing, and Balogun, your man from last time we did this pod, are in there. But I don't know. Duffy, I guess, due to the talisman stuff, is worth looking at. But I haven't got much interest in defence. Do you? Like, I think we should move forward to the midfield.
Yeah, exactly. We'll just have to rely on Potter casting some defensive charms to try and secure that back line next season. But I think in the midfield, they've obviously lost Knockhart to Fulham. And, you know, that's potentially a blow to them, not perhaps considering Knockhart's very mercurial performance in the Premier League over the last couple of seasons. And they have signed, who you mentioned briefly earlier, Trossard from the Belgian League. He cost £6 million in FPL. It's very similar to sort of Wesley. I sort of looked at his sort of stats in the Upala Pro League. He's sort of 85 appearances, 24 goals and 14 assists. And like Wesley, it'll be very interesting to see how he adapts to the much tougher pace of the Premier League. You mentioned Benteke being sort of a previous alumni that succeeded in the Premier League after coming from the Belgian League. There have also been other fails, such as Laurent Depretre, who did very well in the Belgian League and obviously suffered quite heavily when he was in my zombie team last season for Huddersfield. Oh.
I remember you kept going off the bench, didn't you? And he kept doing absolutely nothing. The only one I think we could probably highlight is Pascal Gross. A slight downgrade at 6.5 this year. 164 points in his first year in the Premier League. 7 goals, 8 assists and bonus galore, including a famous three-pointer at Old Trafford. Last season, despite only playing 25 games, Gross created more than any Brighton player. 54, level with likes of Pogba. And he underachieved his XGI as well. So he actually was involved in 6 returns, but he should have been involved in at least 9. I mean, he created 86 chances in that first season in the Premier League when he was famously part of our talisman theory. And the year before, when he came from relegated Ingolstadt in Germany, he created more chances that year for a relegated team than Mesut Özil, who was then not a laughing stock, did in the Premier League. Trossard, you've got the likes of Jakambash as well, is Kiedo, like all of these sort of like flair wingers who have been at Brighton and not really done anything. But Wee Rogue, and our contributor, sent me a few Stats Bomb articles which showed that they were all kind of based on analytics and analytic FPL Simon. And he also points out Bissouma is also part of their kind of analytic strategy under Dan Ashworth. So maybe it was, you know, a Stats Bomb said this, maybe it was Houghton's conservatism, which meant that Dan Ashworth's kind of more analytic stuff wasn't quite worked in. But I mean, we'll have to see moving forward to the attack. The old warhorse, Glenn Murray, and a few people have been saying about him as a 6.0, but is he a herring, Nick?
Well, to be honest, actually, I mean, last season he did manage to score 13 goals somehow, which is a bit of a surprise because I can't seem to remember a single one of them actually happening. But that's the same output as Jimenez and Lacazette. They both all scored 13 goals. And then the season before as well, Murray managed 12. So if he can get that sort of output for a sort of 6 million pounds forward, you don't really tend to expect much more than that, do you? I mean, Murray, he's obviously a decent pick. He's probably one of the better picks in that Brighton side. Yeah, he is obviously a relatively limited player, and he is aging, as you said. I think he's, what is he, 35 now or something? So you have to wonder if his minutes are going to be managed and if we're going to see the likes of Lacadia, who we said we weren't going to mention, and Florin Andone perhaps getting more minutes and Murray being rotated a little bit.
I'm glad you said Andone, Nick. I just need to mention him. 5.0. Never been too prolific. His best record is 12 goals and 37 appearances for Deportivo in 2016-17. But if he starts and takes the mantle, Lacadia, I think, is probably more of a winger, let's be fair. As long as he's scoring at that rate, at Deportivo, a goal every 3 games, he could be hot value at 5.0. But I think that Murray, like the old warhorse, is worth a little bit of a look, isn't he? Like, early season. I wouldn't be too negative about that, because if he's looking like he's starting in pre-season, like, he doesn't have to be mobile. He hasn't been mobile for a few years now, and he's still knocking them away. He's like a poor man's Jamie Vardy almost, because he's able to knock them away with a few chances. We'll have to see what happens obviously in the transfer window there with Brighton, but I think it's fair to say from my part, I'm only really interested in maybe Matt Ryan if I want to have a set and forget keeper sort of thing going on, but I don't think he's actually a very good goalkeeper. Maybe Murray if I want a 6.0 punt, because their start of the season actually isn't too bad.
Exactly. I know, obviously, you're a fan of Pascal Gross, who you mentioned earlier as well, and he was in your team sort of last season. But yeah, I think that's it really for Brighton assets. We're not going to go too close to them, especially after last season. Just see how Potter does. We're going to take a quick break there, and after the break, we're going to be moving on to Bournemouth.
Who got the assist?
Hello, so we're back, and it's time to look at the cherries, Nick. It's time to look at Bournemouth. Defensively, I think we should start and say forget it. Howe has definitely changed tactics in the past. He's been following the gourd towards being more defensive in those games, but they haven't been able to keep solid in the 14th place finish, perhaps reflects their true status. 61 goals conceded in 2017-18, up again to 70 last year, and a real home-away split again. So at home, they were better. They were definitely better at Dean Court. So 1.58 goals per game, conceding 1.32. But away from home, they scored 1.37 and conceded on average a stonking 2.37. Which goes to show that defending really was optional for these guys. They finished with a goal difference of minus 13. They didn't actually concede that many shots on target, 173, 2 more than United and 2 less than Southampton, so mid-table. But can we trust them? No. I mean, in goal as well, Nick, I mean, you've got the likes of Begovic, haven't you, who conceded the joint most areas leading to goal alongside Leno last season.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see who their first choice goalkeeper is. Begovic and Boric were pretty terrible all season, weren't they? But then we saw young Mark Travers get his debut. And of course, he was fantastically solid against Spurs when we played him in the closed season. So he could potentially be a young goalkeeper who gets nailed on. But yeah, like you said, defensively, Bournemouth were pretty damn terrible last season, conceding 70 goals. That was sort of third worst in the league, more than the likes of Cardiff, who obviously got relegated. So yeah, pretty shocking. I think they do have a competent defender in Nathan Ake, where he's far too expensive at 5 million for us to consider him, considering Bournemouth's poor form in defence. And then you've got the likes of Smith, who I've seen in a few drafts, 4.5, and Rico maybe 4.0 if he's nailed on, but it doesn't seem like he is. So be one to sort of watch there perhaps.
Yeah, with Adam Smith, to answer Let's Talk FPL Andy's constant joke, Adam Smith is never the answer. Like, damningly last season, Rico made more crosses than Smith. He made the most crosses of any Bournemouth defender with 39 in just 12 appearances. So it's a case of just ignoring that Bournemouth defender altogether. I mean, if 5.0 Ake gets to Man City, he's left footed. If Laporte's injured, then Ake's the man to buy. But other than that, just ignore. But last season, I mean, they did start strong. So the first 10 games last season, they won 6, drew 2 and lost 2 and scored in 7 of those 10 games. And they had one big team in that run, Chelsea, who they lost to. This year, they've got 2, but similar schedule, especially with the 2 newly promoted sides at the beginning, means we should be looking at them. I think that although it's a big pronouncement, I think that one, at least, is probably essential, isn't it, Nick, in the early kind of stages? And I guess the midfielders, Brooks and Fraser, are where we should start here.
So, yeah, like we said, the defence is a bit of a write-off, but Bournemouth have some fantastic fixtures and they're really attacking last season. Looking at their first 7 fixtures, they play Manchester City in game week 3, which is obviously a tough fixture, but other than that, they play Sheffield United, Villa, Leicester, Everton, Southampton, West Ham. Some really tasty fixtures there. And the midfield, if we start there, with Brooks and Fraser, I was a bit disappointed about Brooks' price in the end. I thought he was going to be a kindly 5.5, but they upped his price. So I think for me, out of the two, I think Ryan Fraser perhaps would be the one that I'd strongly consider. He was sort of third for chances created of all midfielders with 92. And it was this big chances created stat that was really damn impressive last season, with 28 big chances created causing 14 assists, which was second only to Eden Hazard.
Yeah, certainly. He created 11 of those, Nick, in his first 10 games. So just going to show how quick he starts. So he also smashed in an astonishing 271 crosses last season, more than any other player. And he's well worth the 2.0 rise from 7 goals, 14 assists and 181 points as his haul. I agree with you on Brooks. I wish it was a bit cheap. Fraser, is he worth 1.0? Probably. Like, he was the runaway hero of the value analysis that I've done. You know, last season at 5.5, Fraser was an absolute steal for 180 plus points. That's ridiculous. At 7.5, that's still pretty damn good. Fraser beat the likes of Luca Dean. He beat the likes of Sadio Mane. He beat the likes of Gylfi Sigurdsson and beat the likes of Kepa as being a value option in FPL because of how cheap he was. And this year as well, but at 7.5, that's pretty decent with those two very, very strong starts in games. As you mentioned, like, the creativity is ridiculous and he also offers goal threat and he can get you double digits whenever. It looks like he's going to stay there for the rest of his year on the contracts, and I think that he's definitely worth it. But you've obviously got those two strikers there, haven't you, Nick? And not Solanke. Don't get him. He must be good in training or something. I'm not sure why he was filled over Calvert-Lewin by Boufarouk on 21s, for example. Mousset's been pushed out. He's at Sheffield United 5.0, but I just don't see what Solanke is for. But it's all about King versus Wilson, I think, isn't it, Nick? And I think we all started off thinking, yeah, it's definitely King because of that hell of a price differential. But now we're looking at maybe Wilson again a little bit too after the talisman work and other work, for example, done by Will from Basketball Hub.
Yeah, I think for me, but when it comes between Wilson and King, you might disagree with myself, but I'm still very strongly in the King camp. I think the 1.5 million difference between Wilson and King just isn't worth the outlay. I mean, we look at, like, King's supposedly on penalties, but I know Wilson outscored King by 27 points last season, but he actually only scored 2 more goals. It was the assist that sort of made the difference between their points outlay last season. Wilson managed to get 9 assists versus King's 3. But when I actually looked at the chances created stats between King and Wilson, King actually created more chances than Wilson. He sort of, King had 34 compared to Wilson's 30, but Wilson sort of had 13 big chances, which is sort of the joint highest for forwards. But King actually wasn't that far behind either with 10 big chances in third. So I think the reality is, like, the sort of the assist gap was more pronounced in terms of the points that it ended generating, with sort of 9 assists for Wilson versus King's 3. And I think that's a bit unfortunate for King in the end of the day. He was just quite unlucky that the chances he created didn't end up being goals in comparison to the chances that Wilson created. So that's why I kind of thought, oh, you know, there's this 1.5 million difference between these guys. But in reality, I think they're actually a lot closer in terms of their potential points output.
Yeah, certainly. In terms of the value analysis, King is not too far from Wilson. There's 0.49 points per million if we factor in appearance as part of that. But of the 12 goals by King, 5 were penalties and 1 was from a set piece. So it means that half his output was from dead balls and in high XG situations, which throws off a lot of the data that a lot of people have cited. As you mentioned, obviously it was the assists that made the difference and the value that makes a difference in King's favour. But in terms of the stats, in terms of his talisman status, Wilson is looking like, for that 1.5 million, there could be a case for him. At the start of last season, 5 goals and 5 assists for Wilson versus 4 goals and 4 assists for King. And King only actually contributed in game week 3. It's one of those things, isn't it, where actually I can see your point of view, like value is definitely resting with King, and that 1.5 million that can turn a Tarkowski into a Laporte is definitely worth it. The judgment probably is that Wilson can hit a level that King can't hit, but the reality is that Josh King is going to score in game week 1, isn't he? It's disappointment for Wilson owners. I kind of also think that Ryan Fraser, for a lot of the work that we've done, the value work for example, might be good as a kind of KDB-esque compromise at 7.5.
I think Fraser, again, he looks obviously much better value than Wilson too. I think just for me, Wilson is perhaps a little bit too much, a little bit too expensive, and I'd prefer either Fraser or King if I was covering Bournemouth. But we'll move on now. We'll go on to Burnley, another team where perhaps we're not going to focus too much on the defence and, you know, the merits of Tarko versus me. There are rumours as well at the moment with Tarko supposedly being linked with Leicester to fill the gap of Maguire. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens there. With Ben Gibson perhaps becoming a nailed on 4 million defender, which would be very exciting for us managers, like a cheap 4 million. In terms of goal attempts conceded, they were the worst of all the Premier League teams last season. So they conceded a lot of goals. But I think a lot of people are obviously very interested in the goalkeeper position. And if Heaton moves, then it could be a Nick Pope that I've seen in, you know, loads and loads of teams. So yeah, what do you think of Burnley and starting with the defence, I guess?
Straight off the bat, I'm less interested in last season's data with them than maybe any other side, like maybe Brighton to some extent. The UEL and the small squad was the key reason why they really suffered, and they conceded more goals home and away. 68 conceded in total, which is just one less than Cardiff. But this was a massive jump. So the year before, they only conceded 38 goals, 30 more goals as a result of probably players being knackered by the UEL. They actually scored more goals last season, but their goals conceded per match basically doubled last year. And it could be the Joe Hart effect, you know, a player who should be in the MLS rather than anywhere near a Premier League football pitch. But I think they're just too tired to execute the rigid Dyche game plan. They've been so good in the past that I'm willing to give them a pass. Things like the defensive stats that you mentioned are more of an anomaly. So, for example, the 84 big chances conceded is more in the 50s normally. And the goalkeepers, obviously, it's Hope, Heaton, Hart, Pope, he signed a new contract. Heaton being linked elsewhere, like Villa, and hasn't signed one, and Hart should be in the bin. And in 2017-18, it should be mentioned that Pope was an absolute legend. 11 clean sheets, 113 saves, 152 points. He'd have outscored Lloris, Fabianski and Kepa this year by that measure. And as soon as I saw him at 4.5 million, I bookmarked him. I think he's a pretty good goalkeeper at that price. So his XG prevented in 2017-18 was just 1.4, lower than David De Gea's. And he actually stopped around 4 more expected goals than the United man. He's a very, very good goalkeeper, kind of level of Fabianski in terms of saves. We didn't have Tom Heaton's data back in the day, 2016-17, when he also kept 10 clean sheets and got over the 150-point threshold. But at 4.5 million, it's a rarity that they're so cheap. And they also get bonus as well, because a lot of the players, like Tarko, me, who you mentioned, Ward, who actually hit 5.4 million 1 year, Nick, if you remember him. Those players just whack it away. They're CBI specialists, which means the goalkeeper, for passing it to a defender, to whack away tends to get more bonus. So yeah, that defense is definitely worth looking at. Moving forward to the midfield, I guess McNeil
We talked a bit about McNeil, I guess, in the pre-season before the prices were announced. We were like, oh, he could be a really good pick as a cheap pick at 5 million or 5.5. When we saw the 6 million, we were a bit like, oh, for God's sake, why did they price him up? I mean, he only managed to score 3 goals over the course of the season. So it's not massive output, but yeah, we got priced up to 6 million, which completely puts us off him. I think in terms of the Burnley midfield, there's not much to talk about really at all. I mean, there's the likes of Goodmanson. He had the most goal attempts of all the Burnley midfielders with 33, but still less than the likes of Mayo at Crystal Palace, Stanislas at Bournemouth and MacArthur at Crystal Palace and even Hoylett at Cardiff. So, you know, there's very little going on there, very little attacking options. McNeil's obviously is quite an exciting young player, but, you know, like I said, 6 million, we really need to see a little bit more from him in terms of attacking output before we actually consider him as an FPL asset. I think it's more the front line that perhaps is a little bit more interesting in the Wooden Barnes at 6.5 million.
I mean, it was all about them, I think, until J-Rod came back. But Burnley fans like FPL Claret and Turfy Topper seem to think it will remain that way. Wood was actually the talisman last season at appearance point removed, but not by much. 1.16% separated the two. But looking at last season's data, which I will use for the attackers, the XG for number one Austrian striker Ashley Barnes was just incredible. It's a non-pen XG of 12.25. In comparison, Wood had 6.15 open play XG. Just to place Barnes' numbers in context, in the second half of the season, his XGI was higher than the likes of Jamie Vardy, Raul Jimenez, Alex Lacazette, Callum Wilson and Marcus Rashford. What a hero. Barnes had more shots and created more chances than Wood on average. And even though the fixtures are quite meh, Southampton, Arsenal, Wolves and Liverpool were the first four. So those numbers are crazy, aren't they? And could be worth a punt. Wow, basically.
Yeah, and I think come game week 5, actually, they've got a really nice run of fixtures. Brighton away, Norwich at home, Villa away, Everton at home, Leicester away. I mean, the first four are quite nice, at least. And with Barnes, he's certainly an option. He got 12 goals last season with 3 assists. And, he fits in quite nicely into that third striker bracket. I mean, we're not saying he's the Messiah. Perhaps he's just a very naughty boy. But I actually looked at, you know, Barnes versus King, because King's obviously a guy that's in a lot of teams. And I looked at the ownership stats, actually. I mean, I know we don't like to talk about ownership this sort of stage of the season when it's a few weeks before it actually starts. But King currently has an ownership of 20.7% compared to Barnes' only 0.9%, which is actually less than the likes of Success and Khedija. So he's really getting ignored at the moment. But in terms of the stats between Josh King and Ashley Barnes, they actually had really similar levels of numbers last season. Sort of Barnes had 30 goal attempts on target, for instance, compared to King's 23. King had sort of 72 shots compared to Barnes' 65. So Barnes perhaps has the superior stats in some metrics. And really sort of flying under the radar and getting ignored at this moment in time by most FPL managers for sure.
Yeah, it just seems like Nick Pope, maybe Charlie Taylor at 4.5 at the back are the ones that people are looking at. But I think Barnes could be very interesting. Even though the early fixtures aren't that great, I think he could really do a job for you at 6.5. Okay, let's move on to Chelsea then, Nick. And actually, before we get into it, I had a chat very recently with at FPL Physio Tom about the side he supports Chelsea and what his views are about how his team will do next year.
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
I'm not bad, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Talk to me quickly, Tom, about the Blues and what do you think is going to happen this year with the transfer ban? How do you rate your chances with that?
It's interesting with Frank obviously taking over. It's a good move for him to come in. Obviously, a divided fan base last year. We need that like Klopp Pep effect with the fans, get the fans back on side. I think we'll be challenging for fourth this year with you and Man United. Yeah. I can't see us catching Liverpool or City, and I think Spurs are a bit unpredictable.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a sad state of affairs, isn't it? When we're all aiming for fourth,
yeah. We
know that the top two are way out of it, and then third, yeah, probably going to be Spurs, as much as it saddens me. Since Tottenham is not going to come around for a long time. So in FPL then, I guess all eyes are on the Hazard replacement. Pulisic's been signed, you've got Willian. I guess you've got the strikers as well, quite kindly priced. I mean, Giroud is 7.0, and I guess by the time this actually goes out, we'll perhaps know what Tammy Abraham's and Batshuayi perhaps going to be. But how do you think that's going to shake out in FPL? Like, who are you going to be looking at for Chelsea?
Well, yeah, replacing Hazard's not going to be easy. I think everyone's going to have to step up. I think the first name that stands out is Willian, because when Hazard had that off year with Jose, he did step up. And I think all four wingers are going to have a big role to play this year. Pulisic, I mean, he's been in good form for the US, getting some goals and assists. But I think we can look at Chelsea for the first two game weeks, United and Leicester. And then after that, they got promoted sides and then a good run. I think they only play Liverpool up to game week 14. So yeah, I think to watch them for the first 2 weeks and pre-season, obviously, see how they set up.
I mean, we haven't mentioned the mean defence either, but surely they're going to churn out points.
Yeah, I think, you know, 15 clean sheets is probably what we're looking at. The last 2 years, I think it's 15 and 16. I think Aspilicueta at 6 stood out because I think he will play probably 37, 38 games. And he got 6 assists last year playing at right back. He always gets points. I think Jorginho at 5, if he's on penalties. I don't know if he's going to start, if I'm honest. Could be Willian as well. I think him and Pulisic will start the season. Although I think Hudson-Odoi, when he comes back at 6, looks really good. Same with Loftus-Cheek at 6-5. When they come back, I think they'll be mainstays in the side. And obviously the striker, quite similarly priced. Whichever one of them gets the number one. I mean, a top 6 striker at 7 million. What's not to love about that?
Yeah, certainly mouth-watering. A final question for you quickly, Tom. I've got a little feeling that Ross Barkley is going to be a force to be reckoned with this year. He was a box-to-box player at Everton and he really flourished for a couple of seasons. And I just wonder whether Lampard's going to see something of himself perhaps in Barkley and really put some trust in the Englishman. Like, what do you think about that?
Actually, funnily enough, I did have him in a draft the other day because I saw his price at 6 and it just fitted in nicely. Having watched tactical videos, Lampard plays with a three with a defensive mid and then two attacking midfielders. And I think to start the season, it could well be him and Mason Mount. And yeah, I mean, if he's in that team, then because of Hazard not being there, he's going to need to contribute. And maybe Lampard can bring out the best in him. There's no one better to teach a midfielder how to score goals.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when he was at Everton, back in the day, hopefully something there. But yeah, Mason Mount as well will be very interesting when he's added. All right, thanks for that, Tom. Really, really interesting. Thanks for coming on. And we'll try to have you on for a full pod later on in the year.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Good to make my podcasting debut.
Cheers. Great cameo.
So that was really interesting, wasn't it, Nick? Just hear about Tom's views. Chelsea, so on the overall level, they score 1.57 goals at home, conceded 0.84. And the way they actually scored 1.68 goals per match and conceded 1.16. So 63 goals, 6 from top, 39 conceded, 4 from bottom. Conceded the least free shots in the box, third least shots on target, and fourth least big chances. Really scary numbers, I think, in terms of the defence to be overlooking in the upcoming period. And I think a lot of us, with our big at the backs, have still managed to exclude a Chelsea player from that, including myself, actually. But their defence is very settled, and with no outgoings because of the transfer ban under Lampard, I think that defence is probably the first place to look for Chelsea, isn't it? And that's been backed up by the value analysis.
Yeah, definitely. I think defensively, they've always remained solid. And last season was no exception. We saw 16 clean sheets. They were just behind City and Liverpool, 20 and 21 respectively. And 39 goals conceded was the sort of joint third best in the Premier League. At the moment, I've got Kepa in my team in terms of my sort of big at the back setup. He's obviously nailed on goalkeeper. He's 5.5 million. So he's a little bit cheaper way to get a premium goalkeeper. And he fits quite nicely. He's in my team. I think Chelsea in general is sort of it's very interesting this year. It's a sort of exceptional case of there's usually a sort of flying circus of transfer money flying around, isn't there? But Roman's not allowed to spend money this summer. But what's Latin for Roman? Because he's still managed to secure Kovacic's services for last year and also made the shrewd acquisition of Christian Pulisic, who we'll talk about. But yeah, with Hazard out of the picture, it really is a season of bargain options for Chelsea. It's sort of the highest value player that you could buy for Chelsea being 7.5 million. It's just ridiculous, isn't it?
It's only a way for Finn Mint in your budget to buy a Chelsea player. I mean, you've got Kepa at the moment. Understand that. 14 clean sheets in 36 games last season. But worryingly, his save percentage was less than the likes of Foster and Rui Patricio. And he also narrowly beat out Sergio Rico at 76.7%. So, yeah, I don't know. Under Lampard, Derby actually last season were pretty solid at home. Didn't concede very much at all. So 0.88 goals per game, which isn't very far from Chelsea's 0.84 per game and first in clean sheets. In terms of that defence, I think that's where we should be looking because now the value seems to have gone from the front line, but that defence is still kind of composed. It's really interesting to see what will happen there. So I looked at the data. I was surprised to see that Alonso was still second for shots overall, though Doc's 46 shots were garnished by the fact that 40 of those shots were in the box versus Alonso's 25. But Assis Alonso kind of came to be last season, didn't he? He scored far fewer goals, 2 down from 7 and 6 the years before, but assisted 8 times alongside banking 14 clean sheets, which is pretty decent. It'd be interesting to see if Lamps fancies Alonso or whether it's going to be all about Palmieri there. We just don't know.
No, we don't at this stage. And obviously, I've always been a big fan of Alonso's. And as you said, his attacking stats, who we've quoted many times on this pod before, have always been brilliant and really high. I think Chelsea fans obviously never been a fan of Alonso because they actually watch the football and see the amount of defensive mistakes that he tends to make and sort of being caught out of position all the time. But from a sort of FPL perspective, we enjoy Alonso, and when he gives us those attacking returns, we really enjoy it. But he always starts quite strongly. I remember last season, no one had him in his team, and then in game week two, he scored that 16-point return, I think it was, which everyone sort of rushed to get him in after that. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with him, certainly, and if he can nail down that left-back slot ahead of Emerson. But in the centre of defence, David Luiz actually ended up being the top scorer for Chelsea in that defence. 164 points he secured. He's definitely an option at only 6 million, or Aspilicueta, who's also the club captain and seems to have that right back slot nailed down.
Alonso actually scored more points last season than Aspilicueta, who also relinquished the top BPS man spot to VVD this year. He only scored a paltry 11 bonus points last season compared to 25 and 22 in prior seasons. Six assists once more, though. Alonso actually created more chances as well than Aspilicueta, with David Luiz down in 17 in terms of chances created. But a killer stat, Nick. Of the 17 chances David Luiz created, 11 of those were big chances. 11. That's pretty mental, actually. Which means that his XGI wasn't far off Alonso's at all. 5.36 to 5.96. And he was also better in the bonus. David Luiz only scored 3 goals and got 2 assists due to the misfiring Chelsea strikers. But that's quite something. 11 big chances created. 19 BPS too, which is more than Aspilicueta's actually. DFKs, I think, maybe for long shot attempts, but you know, you've got to remember that FPL reuser, at reuser 5 is good thread on why it doesn't matter too much. But any potential revenue stream of points counts, right? I mean, even Aspilicueta, who may be at 6.0, the one you'd be looking at. Like a few Chelsea fans, like Simon Phillips on Twitter, has been saying that maybe Reece James is being asked for because Dave's age may be beginning to tell. And alongside him, you know, Christensen 5.0 could be interesting. It looks like Zuma's going to stay, Tomori, because Rudiger's missing. But I guess the midfield where the void being filled by Haz is what's interesting, as Tom said, about maybe Barkley, maybe somebody else stepping up.
Yeah, definitely. I think obviously when you talk about bonus points as well, we know that Hazard was a little bit of a bonus point hog because of all the chances that he would create and his unselfishness. So if he's no longer in the side, you have to wonder where those bonus points are going to go. And they're probably going to go into those defenders like Aspilicueta and David Luiz, who you mentioned, obviously with their creativity last season. But yeah, in the midfield, obviously there are a number of options out there, all very cheap. I know one you want to talk about is Ross Barkley. And I'm not so sure about him, but I know he's been in some of your FPL drafts. So do you want to explain that, perhaps?
So Ross Barkley is down to 6.0. I know people may be thinking that I'm doing the Ministry of City Walks right now towards Barkley. But I want to give a shout out to his golden years at Everton, 2015, 2016. And 2016-17. In those 2 years, he scored 158 points in 15-16, 8 goals and 9 assists. 2016-17, he scored 144 points, 5 goals and 11 assists. And there's something about the Bentekes about Barkley for me. He's a real falling star, all the way down to 6.0 from 7.5 million mid in his heyday. As Tom said, maybe Lamps will be the perfect man to see a player in this mould and help him along. So we saw that with Man United as well when Solskjaer was helping out Rashford initially, arguably. I just want to cast your mind back to 2015-16 as well, when Barkley was fourth overall from attempts from midfielders with 95 attempts at goal, first 9 in the box. And in 2016-17, he was 8th as well. Just 6 behind Dele Alli, who we'll talk about in next week's NW podcast as being a bit of a fallen star. Super flimsy, I suppose. But yeah, at 6.0, you're in Ponty territory and you've got the likes of Che Adams or, I don't know, Glenn Murray there. But with fixtures, proven effectiveness, an FPL asset, why not? Just like Barkley's a starter. Like, you've got Kovacic as well and a new contract Mount, who scored 9 goals, got 4 assists in the Championship last year. But yeah, the likes of Jorginho, Kante at 5.0, like, they're not really FPL assets. You're expecting 2.5 points per game. So if you've got that extra 1.0, why not Barkley? Obviously, there's a lot more of interest to talk about in the wingers, like Tom mentioned about Willian, for example. But Barkley, Nick, surely there's got to be some love there.
I'm going to have to send disagreement in your general direction there, I'm afraid. I think, you know, you look at Barkley, say 6 million value, but you can actually get you know, sort of 6.5 million, you can fit the likes of Iosi Perez in your team. So, you know, just a 0.5 more and you get a proper player in as opposed to Ross Barkley. And, you know, you mentioned obviously that season where he was particularly good. But it's sort of a long time actually in terms of FPL. These were the days when Alexis Sanchez would score you 260 points. And as you said, Ali did very well. And Christian Benteke was a star of our teams alongside Charlie Austin. It was quite a long time, to be honest. It'll be interesting definitely to see how Barkley does. I know Loftus-Cheek's injured at the moment, but there's still a lot of competition for that midfield slot. And Mount seems to be the guy that Lampard's really you know, promoting at the moment. Did very well at Derby and just secured a five-year deal. And Kovacic, they've just said, spent a bucket load on. He's cost them about 30 million. And you think, oh yeah, Kante surely nailed. And Jorginho surely nailed in that central midfield slot. You have to wonder how Barkley fits in. And it was sort of all season last year, we saw a lot of sort of Barkley Kovacic rotation by Sarri. And so just for me, I just think he's too much of a rotation risk to take that chance on. And at sort of Everton, he was a talisman at Everton. He was well, apart from perhaps Lukaku, but he played with a lot of freedom in an attacking central role. And I just don't think Lampard's going to trust him with that same amount of freedom and expect him to graft more defensively. So for me, I think Jorginho, of those sort of central midfielders, he's the one I'm actually more interested in. Seems to be nailed perhaps on penalties and you know, only costing 5 million. So that's perhaps where I would spend my money. Yeah, should we move on to sort of the more attacking Chelsea assets? I looked at a little bit of Willian, Pedro and Pulisic. There's a little bit of analysis of those guys. So last season, Pedro had perhaps the most attacking threat. He had 8 goals compared to Willian's 3. Willian has sort of a set-piece threat from corners and free kicks, managed 7 assists from to Pedro's 2. And with the set pieces, you know, Vizio is obviously a fan of Willian. You might see with no hazards, Willian playing a more prominent role, you know, in terms of the set pieces. But I think actually the one I was most interested in when I sort of did the analysis was Pulisic. So Pulisic only played 924 minutes last season, made it very hard to do a proper prospect and the prospects on him. But he managed 4 goals and 4 assists in that time. So that's 8 attacking returns. In terms of attacking returns, that was an attacking return every 115.5 minutes of Pulisic, compared to Willian's 209.1 minutes per attacking return and Pedro's 176.8 minutes per attacking return. So Pulisic, in the limited game time he got, he was actually the most attacking of all those players. And he's done very well over the summer in the Gold Cup for USA, scoring 3 goals and 3 assists, where he was supposedly playing sort of a playmaker role in front of a sort of midfield trio. The other guys are over 30. Pulisic's only 20 years old. I think Pulisic is perhaps where you're going to see all the attacking points coming. And, you know, likes of Williams really never hit FPL stardom, has he? In sort of 6 years at Chelsea, he's never scored more than 135 points, which isn't particularly impressive, is it?
No, definitely not. I think Willian is definitely, sorry Tom, but a bit of a B-grade player. Even in that year that Tom cited, when Hazard was a bit quieter, he only got 5 goals and 10 assists, and he's going to average you about 115, 120 points a season. Last season, his 5th chance created, 78, 90 fewer than Hazard, still right, top 20 for assists, but he seems to average about 75 chances created. And what's really depressing is Willian's understats, so 4.35 XG, 1.35 on the XA. That was really close to actually what he achieved. He's a perennial kind of okay sort of player. Pedro as well, 9 goals, 10 assists, 2016-17, 162 points. Did he overperform? I mean, understat again says he should have got 5 assists and 5 goals. He's older now again. Pulisic, yeah, very interesting. We looked at his projection prospects and actually got rid of that season and excited. He had 182 take-ons the year before he got pushed out by Jadon Sancho, but only won 77 of them. So he's not the Hazard replacement fully formed. In contrast, that 77 dribbles complete by Pulisic, Hazard completes 137 last season. I'm still shocked he's 20, but he needs some end product, like XG of 5.48, XA of 5.3 in 2017-18. Wasn't far off what he actually achieved. So he needs to produce, or he becomes another Willian. The striker, though, is interesting. Up in the air, but 7.0, as you mentioned earlier on, could be amazing value. We probably think that Giroud, Batshuayi and Tammy are all going to be price the same, who knows? But yeah, I guess the strikers are where there's some vague interest.
Yeah, definitely. But I think it's hard to really assess them as prospects because we just don't know which one's going to play at this moment in time. Two of them haven't even been priced, which makes it a bit of a challenge to sort of support for analysis. Obviously, you mentioned Abraham when we talked about Aston Villa and his prolificity in the Championship when he was at Bristol City as well. But when he was at Swansea, he never really hit the ground running, didn't he? So it'll be interesting to see how he adapts and makes a step up. That's why he was quite attacking at Crystal Palace and always, you know, looks good, but again, not too much end product. And Olivier Giroud, sort of a historical hero for yourselves at Arsenal, now donning blue and winning the Europa League. We don't know at the moment in terms of Giroud if he's nailed on, but if he is nailed on, a 7 million forward at Chelsea of Giroud's stature would certainly be a decent selection.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, Giroud's FPL Kylie, sexy man. If he plays over 1,500 minutes, he's on for about 150 points as per his time as Arsenal's main man. Averages about 15 goals per season. He's not always been the latter-day Stefan Gibosh. At 7.0, he could be great value. I mean, you mentioned Batshuayi, obviously not that great. 5 goals in another game for Palace. 1 goal and 15 for Valencia. You'd be hoping that he captures his form at Marseille when he scored 17 goals and 9 assists in the season when he moved to Chelsea after that. But I just don't know. I think it's good to wait and watch for Chelsea. I think they'll be very good for our game week 3-2-3 transfers. But in the beginning, we've got to just see how they set up. Maybe pre-season will help us. But overall, I think that it's really a watch and wait. As much as I like Barkley as a bit of a devilish punt there, I don't think taking punts is necessarily the meaning of life in terms of my FPL anymore. Okay, let's take a break there and we'll be back very soon with Crystal Palace.
Who got the assist? Who got the assist?
So we're back and it's time to speak about Palace. They start with a bit of a mixed bag. Everton at home, Sheffield United away, Man United away, Aston Villa at home, which is good, and then Spurs away. And they were much better away than at home last year in terms of the average goals conceded. And they scored 51 goals and conceded 53. However, they were a decent source of FPL points last season. They actually scored more overall than Manchester United, 1587 to 1544, 43 more than the Red Devils, to end up in 7. As a team, that's more points scored than the likes of Wolves, Leicester, Bournemouth, which is very surprising. They're stubbornly mid-table in all of the team measures, defensive, offensive. One thing they're very, very high on is penalties. So last season, they got 10 penalties. The season before, they got 10 more. 20 goals for Milly Vojovic, 100 points as a gimme for Milly, basically. Wow. But with Zaha potentially leaving, it remains to be seen what sort of Palace we'll see. Zaha last season, for example, actually overcame Raheem Sterling to win fancy assists for the first time in 3 years. He got 6 of them, whereas Raheem Sterling only got 5, and a few of them were recorded on the final day. It's an interesting one, Palace, because I think there's Milly, who many people can get with VAR, there's Zaha hanging around, and there's also Christian Benteke at 6.0, Nick, who, much like a Barkley, I want to speak about just a little bit. What's your view on Palace?
So I think Palace, they're definitely an interesting case. I think they outperformed in terms of FPL points compared to what we would have expected from them. And I think that was partly due to the number of penalties they won and also the number of clean sheets. They only conceded 2 less goals than Arsenal, but they had 5 more clean sheets. I think this defensively, they're very solid last year. But I think that was also largely thanks to Wan-Bissaka's heroics when he won 130 tackles, which is more than any other defender, sort of 92.9% of his tackles he won. And obviously Manchester United have snapped him up. And you look at the backup options, sort of Ward and Kelly, and you see perhaps there's not that much talent there in comparison to Wan-Bissaka. So I think in that respect, they're going to perhaps struggle a little bit more defensively next season without him. Kelly at 4 million, perhaps he's going to start, but with the sort of Tompkins and Sacco's injury statuses, I just can't see them keeping clean sheets with the likes of Kelly in defence. I think I remember a couple seasons ago, we were sort of 3.9 million. He's constantly getting me minus ones and zeros week in, week out. There is one Palace defender, the prominent one we always like to talk about, is Patrick Van Aanholt, sort of 5.5. He's a very attacking defender. Only had 1 goal attempt less than Doherty last season, so with 45, which is the same amount as Alonso's. He scored 3 goals as well. Actually, in the last 5 years, Van Aanholt has been in the top 5 defenders for goal attempts. So he's always got a chance or a goal in him, regardless of whether he's playing for Palace or Sunderland. He gets attacked. A little bit of potential there. And then game week 14 to 21, Palace have a fantastic run of fixtures.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it's a shame that Guaita was bumped to 5.0. Obviously, there's some rotation left with Wayne, don't mention the war, Hennessy. But I mean, he played 20 games last season, had a higher save percentage than the likes of Fabianski and De Gea. So definitely something about him. As you mentioned, Wan-Bissaka losing him is going to be massive. He won 92.9% of his tackles, and only one man can better those numbers amongst players who played more than 3,000 minutes, who is Virgil van Dijk. And he won 38 out of all of his 38 tackles last season, which is pretty ridiculous. But anyway, yeah, PVA, a perennial threat. As you mentioned, he was joint second for defenders last season for shots. And he's also in the top five for XGI amongst current Premier League defenders. Sean Morrison obviously drops out now, but he was third last season. However, it should be always put in context. So that XGI means that you're only looking at six involvements through the whole course of the season, which isn't that good, really, for 5.5 million. Moving forward, I mean, I mentioned Millie in midfield. So last season, obviously, it's absolutely ridiculous how many penalties he's scored. He's scored 24 goals in the Premier League. He's the second highest scoring Serb ever, behind Savo Milosevic of Villa, who scored 29 goals in it. I don't know if you remember him from the old Premier Stickers days, but he scored 17 goals, Millie from pens, 10 goals and 7 goals over the last two seasons, and he scored 3 from set pieces as well. So 20 of his 24 goals in the Premier League have been from dead balls, 83%. Pretty crazy, really. I mean, Zaha, we don't know where he's going to be, but it's worth talking about him quickly in isolation. He got more pen ball touches than any other forward last year, 237. But now he's a midfielder again. He's in the top four, dwarfed by the massive 322 by Mo Salah, 228 by Sterling. And he was just 3 behind Eden Hazard, which is pretty good, actually. So for 7.0, he could be really, really interesting. You have the likes of MacArthur, Townsend, Schlupp in that midfield, who not really worth mentioning at all. I guess moving forward, you've got Wickham before Benteke at 6.0. So there's a few things to mention there. But the midfield and attack, Nick, what are your views?
Zaha's perhaps the most exciting of all the prospects. I know Townsend at 6 million has caught a few people's eye because of his price fall. He was 14th highest for goal attempts in midfield. But as you may have guessed, Tom, as you always like to say about Townsend, his accuracy was pretty damn poor. So yeah, not much end product from Townsend. As I said, Zaha reclassified as a midfielder without a price hike, much like Ayoze Perez. Seems like a little bit of a mistake, to be honest, but from a value perspective and FPL managers like myself, you know, it's quite exciting to look at his price and see what he would have scored. If he was a midfielder last season, he would have scored 164 points, which is more than the likes of Eriksen, Felipe Anderson, who's on the same sort of price as him, and Heung-Min Son as well. So only two less than his teammate Milojevic, who's also 7 million. But I think for me, between Milojevic and Zaha, Zaha would be the one that I would go for. Milly's stats obviously rely quite heavily on Zaha's stats, and Zaha's the sort of more attacking player would be the one that I would pick. But yeah, I think obviously you want to talk briefly about the forward line as well, and not having Batsman will hurt them, but maybe Benteke can step up. He only had one goal and one assist last season for the 6 million man, but yeah, you mentioned the sort of historical seasons, the heady days of 16-17 where he scored 15 goals and got 2 assists.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, you've got Wickham first, 4.5. Yep. Been injured for absolutely ages, but it looks like he's getting time in pre-season for whatever that means. So is Alexandra Sorloff of Hellcheaters fame. But Benteke, 6.0, a big falling star, literally and metaphorically, in that 2016-17 season. As you mentioned, Nick, 136 points from those 15 goals and 2 assists. Also at Palace for Aston Villa as well, back in the day. Now priced at 6.0, prime for your falling star analysis, Nick. But back in that season in question, when he started 7.5 in 2016-17, he was really close to what we think that maybe Haller, who's just joined West Ham, will be. That year, Tekkers, as the target man, hit 95 of his 105 attempts, 90% of his shots inside the box, which works out at 2.7 shots per game, roughly. So if we were filtering on the stats and it was the start of the 2017-18 season, we may be looking at Benteke and thinking he could actually do something. Obviously, Everton, Sheffield United and Man United, the first three aren't very good. But 4 against his old club, Aston Villa, if we was looking at the bright side of life, I think that he should actually be one to rediscover throughout the course of this year. I'm not sure I'll start with him, but he's definitely one I'm going to have an eye on. And I think he's one that's going to be forgotten as well by a lot of people.
So Benteke and Barkley then, Tom. let's move on to Everton, shall we? So Everton, obviously, they have a great fixture run, all the way actually up to game week 15, where they only play two of the top six during that period. And then they have a sort of really horrible sort of batch of fixtures after that. But at the beginning of the season, a lot of people doubling up, like yourself, I think, on Everton. And good reason, sort of Palace away, Watford home, Aston Villa away, Wolves home, Bournemouth away, Sheffield United home. That's fantastic set of six opening fixtures. And if we start though in sort of the back line, we know obviously Pickford's had a bit of a bump to 5.5 million, and that does sort of put me a little bit, to be honest, in terms of Pickford. He's sort of the same price as the likes of Kepa. I think the same price as De Gea. You know, he's a little bit more expensive this season, Pickford, so you know, perhaps not sort of first player to mention. But then there's sort of defence. I think there's a bit of a debate that's ongoing between sort of Lucas Digne and Seamus Coleman. And I think for me and yourself, I think we're big fans of Luca, aren't we? At 6 million. And I've also tweeted about why I think he's a brilliant must-own FPL pick this season.
Lucas Digne, that was a great piece put together actually by Abubakar Sadiq on Twitter. So 71 chances created, just 28 off of Maddison, who we'll speak about in a bit, who got a leading chance created all of 99, which is 20 more than Robertson in just under 3,000 minutes. 280 crosses as well. But that 71 chances created, he got the second most chances created for any defender ever. Leighton Baines, his predecessor, actually had the most chance created ever in 2013-14 with 90, which is mental. And Leighton Baines, actually, the year after, 2014-15, was third with 70 chances created. But yeah, Lucas Digne, for the time being, is very, very good. There's the set pieces argument, but again, that great friend by Reuser 5 showed that Digne has one of the best corner conversion rates, but only a single assist from a total of 89 corners. That being said, he hasn't left my team since game week one, and Coleman is one being pushed by a lot of other people. He's 0.5 million cheaper, and by the basic value metric that's being used by a lot of accounts, that seems to display that Coleman edges it. I get that, but it seems like he's become a bit of a cause célèbre rather than a logical look at the two players in comparison. Purely by looking at a great point by our friend Bernardo Maldonado is that if both were priced the same, I don't think anybody is going to be looking up the stats to support Coleman. A really good point to look at is our value calculations, which show that Coleman appeared in 75% of the available time, Digne at 87% of the available time, Digne got 158 points, Coleman got 125 points. Taking appearance out, 68 for Coleman, 90 for Digne. Coleman created a lot of big chances, 6. Digne created 11. But Digne is 13 points per million compared to 9.25 per million for Coleman. Like, I can see the argument, like, there's best quality chances created by Coleman, etc., etc. But Digne's probably better attuned to the Premier League right now. And I think that there's perhaps some confirmation bias in play with people looking at that big chances stat and extrapolating that to prove a point. As Matt said, if Coleman and Digne were the same price, I don't think people would make him that same argument. But I think that Digne probably is a better source for points than Coleman over the course of the season, especially with Zouma leaving. Where it becomes interesting, obviously, is if I can say I'm going to save that 0.5 from Digne to Coleman. I think that Digne just provides those sort of different streams of points revenue that Coleman doesn't. Like, looking at the numbers over the course of the season, it's a bit of a force of nature, and I think that he definitely is worth that 6.0, especially if we think, well, Everton might concede more goals due to the fact Zouma's not there anymore.
Yeah, I think you've made quite a strong case there, so I'm not going to add any more to why we both think that Lucas Digne is the best pick in that Everton backline. Obviously, you mentioned Zouma leaving or not being re-signed, which probably potentially could give a little bit of a dent in terms of their chances of clean sheets. So it'll be very interesting to see if Yerry Mina can stay fit and act as a suitable partner for Michael Keane in that back line. And I know they've secured the likes of Andre Gomez's services, which should help in terms of the players in front of the defence. But if we move on and move forward, sort of the midfielders, it's the old sort of Gylfi-Richarlison debate. It's another debate, isn't it, in terms of who's the best Everton midfielder. This time round, they're both the same price, so they're both 8 million. It's a tough one, actually, looking at these guys. I know you're a big fan of Siggy. I also owned Siggy at the beginning of the season. This is a bit of sort of, you know, personal bias. But, you know, Richarlison was the dominant force, wasn't he? Well, Sigurdsson didn't do too much. And then I got Richarlison in. he decided to headbutt a Bournemouth player. It was like Mark Pugh or Harry Arter or Adam Smith, one of them. You know, I can't remember. You know, they've all got similar names, haven't they? or Simon Francis, one of the guys, got headbutted, and Richarlison got himself sent off. Give me a total points tally of -2, but Richarlison seems to be that sort of anti-Iosi Perez, doesn't he? He sort of always starts strong. But yeah, in terms of the key stats, Sigurdsson just wins out sort of 55% against 45%, 6+ on the key stats versus +4 for Richarlison. They've got sort of very similar XGs of 0.3 in terms of penalty area touches, which unsurprisingly just edges Sigurdsson. He's 4.4 versus 2.8. And Richarlison's actually more likely to score with 32.3 minutes per attempt compared to Sigurdsson's 36.4. But Sigurdsson had the better shot accuracy. And when it came to chances created, Sigurdsson was far superior with 43 minutes per chance compared to the selfish Richarlison's 128 minutes per chance. And with Sigurdsson being on the set pieces and penalties, although he missed a couple, I think he's perhaps the favoured option personally for myself, and I think you're inclined to agree with that as well.
Yeah, certainly. I think Richarlison, as you mentioned, always starts strong. So last season, a brace on opening day, another the next. So Phil in accounting, who only looked at his FPL team up until game week 3, would have had Richarlison in there because he would have brought them in. The first big bandwagon of last year at 6.5. Milver's blue-eyed boy scored 153 points. First in goals and 3 assists last season, and had the inevitable drop-off after Christmas. So he only scored 3 goals in the last 10. Whereas Siggy was consistent. Siggy is the ideal zombie league of inclusion. So Siggy last season, first in goals, 6 assists, his most goals ever, his most points ever, 182, which beats his previous best in Swansea when he was doing heroics, 181. In his favourite number 10 role in the settled team, in the FPL team of the year as well, Siggy, what's not to love? It feels like an either or, and as you mentioned with the stats, Siggy, similar number of attempts, Richarlison more touches in the box, and more shots in the box, but Siggy created more, his XA was better, and actually his XGOP, so his open play, expected goals, was actually not far off Richarlison's at all, 6.14 for Siggy versus 6.44 for the Brazilian. So I think Siggy offers more overall. Like, you've always got the chance of Siggy creating something. It's just obviously weighing that up against the fact that Richarlison gets going a lot sooner. But I think that, you know, full rest for Siggy versus Richarlison in the Copa America, I do quite like the Icelander. Up front, we've got the DCL, DLC situation. Are you going to have him in for a second season? Same number of attempts as Glenn Murray / Jose Perez, who's now a midfielder. But is DCL 6.0 someone you're interested in, Nick?
In terms of the forward line, you have to consider Dominic Calvert-Lewin at 6 million. You know, that's pretty good value. I mean, he hasn't hit the ground yet in the Premier League. 6 goals, 5 assists, 92 points in total. Wasn't sort of a fantastic output considering the amount of minutes he was given last season. I know Everton are quite heavily linked to various forwards in the transfer window, like the likes of Diego Costa, I heard rumours about. So I think with Calvert-Lewin, you know, I think at 6 million, you're looking at the likes of Glenn Murray, Che Adams. There's a few options out there, but and Calvert-Lewin definitely has to be in your thoughts because he's very good value. But, you know, he's sort of a make weight in your team, really, isn't he? Rather than sort of the leading man at this moment in time, especially considering Everton's fixtures, you do have to consider him.
The key concern with Calvert-Lewin is that his XGI was very low last year, so 6.58, which is the same as bloody Shane Long or Andre Gray. Surely a striker has to come in, because I'm not sure DCL is quite the man to put away the chances created by Sig and Dig. But 6.0 may be a good default if you're shopping around down there for some reason. All right, let's take a quick break there, Nick, and then we'll move on to the final two, Leicester and Liverpool.
Who got the assist?
So we're back, and it's time to talk about Leicester. They're a team that's sort of generating a little bit of excitement, a little bit of buzz at the moment, actually, in terms of what Brendan Rodgers is doing at the club and the players that are bringing in. You know, they're sort of looking very attacking and, you know, a lot of threat. But if we start perhaps at defence, there's obviously sort of a lot of rumour about Maguire moving, which is obviously a little bit of a concern for them. But you know that they've got someone lined up to spend that money on the likes of Lewis Dunk or Tarko, who we mentioned. it's interesting to see what happens there, but could result in a nicer way into that defence depending on who they sign. So a little bit up in the air. We won't spend too much time sort of debating who joins or whatnot. Talking about the fullbacks, perhaps. Ricardo Pereira, $6 million, seems a little bit expensive when that price was announced. Maybe Ben Chilwell at 5.5 would be the preferred attacking Leicester defender.
Wing commander Chilwell is probably the one to be looking at there. But the Leicester defence generally without Maguire, it's an open question, isn't it? So, you know, last year, they did all right. It's 51 goals scored, 48 conceded. But I think Brendan Rodgers coming in is actually really interesting. So in the final 19 games, they made a chance every 6.3 minutes versus one every 8 minutes under Puel in the first 19. It's around the likes of Huddersfield. And that really shows the Bodger effect. And I think the talisman star, Jamie Vardy, is worth talking about quickly, Nick, unfortunately. Normally, I wouldn't be speaking about him and I wouldn't be expecting the Harris Inquisition, but I think I've got to try to reconcile with the fact that Jamie Vardy's stats are really, really good in talisman theory. For example, the exit velocity last season, which I looked at in the Talisman Theory article, shows that since the March data, he actually upped his total of personal points, i.e. points without appearance, from 74 to 110, which is a massive 48.65% percentage points added. It's obviously assisted by Tiedemann's a lot or whatever. Vardy is one of those players that actually perennially flies under the radar. So, little known fact, he's actually a bonus hog. He scored the most bonus points over the last two seasons of any other player, 31 last year, 28 points the season before. That's because, linking to the second fact, he's unlike Mo Salah. He doesn't take very many shots, and he's very accurate when he does. So he doesn't get penalised by the bonus point system when he does take those shots. It's a 48% accuracy from 74 shots last season, which translates into a really decent XG. He's the second highest for forwards, higher than Kun Aguero. And his XGI is actually in third, with Kun overtaking slightly on XA. And although it's a bit of an awkward price at 9.0, I think that the talisman analysis alone showed me he was definitely worth considering, even if the value analysis might be pointing me in another direction.
Yeah, it sounds like Rodgers can release Vardy. But for me, I think for my concern with Vardy is he is the most expensive option in that Leicester team. He's £9 million compared to Iosi Perez being £6.5 million. So if you don't go with Perez and you want Vardy, you're basically suggesting that he's worth stumping an extra £2.5 million, as well as saying, actually, I'm also happy to sacrifice that extra goal and extra clean sheet point because I'm content and believe that Vardy can output Perez that much. Last season, Perez, if he was a midfielder, would have got 164 points versus Vardy's 174. So I don't think that Vardy was the value for money over Perez last season, considering he only got 10 more points. I mean, Vardy also turns 33 this season, so you do have to wonder if his miniature can be managed a little bit more, maybe. I don't know. But that being said, I do understand the appeal of people that bringing in a player like Vardy, who is likely to get you 18-plus goals, and we know that he is definitely capable of achieving that.
Yeah, I think that Perez actually is the choice, really, in that midfield triumvirate of Tielemans, Maddy and Perez. Perez would have been the third highest-value player in the Leicester team, and pushing out Maddison, actually, if he'd have joined last season and played last season for them with the numbers. And if we recalculated those numbers to include the midfield points of Perez, which we didn't do because of the ifs and buts, Perez would probably have been the second best value player for the Leicester team, which is pretty crazy. So I think that's our endorsement of Perez, but there's obviously your thread on this, Nick, which we're hoping doesn't turn into a Neil Murray-esque Ricardo Pereira thread. But looking at Tielemans and Maddy actually is quite interesting, because over the course of last season, I did a little bit of a comparison on a per-game basis, just because Tielemans played less time than Maddison, of course. Tielemans had a slightly worse XG and XA, but he had more attempts, more on target, and made more through balls than Maddy per game as well. Maddy was a winner on chance creation and pen box touches. But is Maddy worth the extra 0.5? Like, from watching them, Tielemans' all-action style, I actually quite like. I'm not too averse owning him over Maddison, to be honest, but I just think that Perez as the potential like shadow striker offers you a little bit more, doesn't he? Just because that basically fills the role of that kind of 6.5 budget midfield talisman spot in your roster, who has a double-digit return in his Arsenal.
For me, I think Perez is my preferred option. Though I do understand that Maddison and Tielemann, in looking at them sort of alone and isolated, they are actually really good FPL picks in their own right, to be honest. You know, like Tielemann, he had this fantastic 4.8 points per game after joining Leicester, which was one of the highest amongst all midfielders last season, having scored 3 goals and 5 assists. Maddison, as you mentioned earlier in the pod, 99 chances created, more than any other player last season. So both of them are really good picks in their own right. And I certainly can understand the appeal of having either of those guys in your team. And I'm not necessarily thinking that Leicester worth doubling up on, but there's certainly a plethora of options in terms of that front line. I mean, Leicester's fixtures, to be honest, they aren't that great, to be honest. So, you know, maybe later on in the season, we will see chances for doubles up, perhaps sort of come game week 9. But, you know, they open up with Wolves, Chelsea, Sheffield United, Bournemouth, United, Spurs. So it's a sort of a bit of a mixed bag, I guess. But I've still got a sort of backing Iosi's Perez's corner at this moment in time, through hell or high water, it seems, as my preferred option. But, you know, there are other options out there, I guess. Perez might not necessarily be nailed on. It's a little bit of a concern. With the likes of Harvey Barnes, who somehow got the $6 million price tag despite only scoring 1 goal last season, much to our frustration, and Demarai Gray, who surprisingly only got the $5.5 million price tag, actually making him a pretty good value pick, to be honest, with his 4 goals and 1 assist last season.
Yeah, if he plays now, Perez there. No, I get that. I just get the feeling that that tough start screams Vardy. It's just whether the value and what you lose elsewhere is worth that kind of trade-off. I just don't know about that, and it's something that we're thinking about over the course of the preseason. So, final team is Liverpool, Nick. The big team that we're going to talk about today, actually, I think, let's not count Arsenal in that. Let's not count Chelsea in that. The first of the top four. 2.89 goals per game last season at home, 0.53 conceded. 1.79 goals away last season, 0.63 conceded. And they won 9 more points than Man City in an FPL context last season. So they topped it for the first time ever. In terms of the attacking and defensive measures, they were always second to City. So they took 100 fewer shots than City. Chelsea actually beat them out as well, but only scored 6 fewer goals. And it's the same old story, isn't it, with them, except that our value work has shown that defence is absolutely ridiculous value, isn't it?
Yeah, I think with Liverpool, we've talked so much about them on previous pods that we're not going to sort of spend another hour discussing Liverpool at this late stage of this pod. But, you know, needless to say, we're both huge fans of Liverpool and tripling up. Not real fans, let's say FPL fans, just to clarify. And both will be tripling up on them at the start of this season. Obviously, they start the season with Norwich at home, which brings back many memories of Luis Suarez, who scored 3 hat-tricks against the Canaries and got 12 goals in 6 appearances. So it'll be interesting to see if the likes of Mo Salah can repeat Suarez's heroics. And then after that, it's Southampton, Arsenal, Burnley, Newcastle. So, you know, a really fantastic run of fixtures at the start of the season, meaning that, you know, a lot of excitement about Liverpool in terms of FPL. And yeah, the defence obviously was amazing last season with their 21 clean sheets, and especially, you know, Van Dijk, Alexander-Arnold and Robertson. Robertson getting 213 points, just unheard of for a defender, you know, outscoring all forwards in the game. It was just incredible season for him. And, you know, Alexander-Arnold shattering the assist record with 13 assists. And, you know, we want to see more of the same. They're priced up, obviously, this season, thanks to last season, what they did. But, you know, I thought the FPL could have been, you know, really hard on us and made Robertson 8 million and TAA 8 million and, you know, give us some really tough decisions to make in terms of can we really afford to put that much in our back line. But I think a 7 million from our sort of budget value analysis still means that there are, you know, fantastic bargain picks. You're talking about a player that scored over 200 points only costing 7 million. You know, what's not to love in that? And for me, I'm happy to double up on the Liverpool defence. It's worth mentioning, of course, before you speak about Joe Gomez as well, potential cheaper way into that back line. But it's all about Robbo and TAA.
Alisson is unfortunate to miss out. He's actually played 5,130 minutes over 57 matches in the 2018-19 season, which only ended the other day. Absolutely crazy, really. Virgil van Dijk is the value king. We looked at the data for our upcoming value piece, which will release next Friday. And van Dijk really is, by being 0.5 cheaper than TA and Robbo, the value king over the course of it. Hit the 200 points at just 6 last season. Really, really crazy. However, I think I can understand why people are looking at VVD 0.5 cheaper over the course of the season, scored more than TAA and scored very close to Robbo. The fact is that week to week, the ceiling for TAA and Robbo is a little bit higher. The floor is higher than VVD over the course of the season, but week to week, TAA and Robbo are higher than that, which means that I'm favouring those two, and I can always go down 0.5 and buy Virgil van Dijk if I'm in trouble. But I think that TAA and Robbo are probably the two best defenders, it looks like, in terms of a clean sheet motivation, and also in terms of attacking potential. Obviously, you've got the likes of Laporte and David Luiz, as mentioned, but those two are absolutely crazy. And I think just qualitatively as well, like watching them play against weaker teams, like not having either of those two players is so painful that I think that owning both of them is really, really important. In the midfield, Salah, can't see past him, can we, Nick?
No, you can't see past Mo Salah, and you're obviously talking about players that had long seasons in Alisson's and Sadio Mane's season only just finished 2 days ago, unbelievably, in the African Cup of Nations, going all the way to the final there with Senegal and unfortunately losing as well. And I think this season Mane's price has gone up, obviously. So it's only the 1 million between Mane and Salah. And I just think it's all about Mo for me personally. Obviously, Mane ended up matching Salah as well in terms of goals, with both scoring 22 goals last season. But I don't think that Mane will necessarily start the season as well, which is a little bit of a concern, obviously, for Liverpool. So I think for me, it's all about Mo. He's going to be the auto-captain for game week one, and he's the must-own player, isn't he?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if Mane was fit, there'd be an argument, but the XG and the XGI shows Mane massively outperforming. To get to his 22 goals last season, only a few assists, 3 of which 2 were FPL assists, and Salah basically matched his expected output with that 22 goals. If we're to see a regression with Salah, it was last season. So the stellar 300 plus points in the first year, where he scored 1% of FPL points, regressed back to where he was. But to score 250 points per season, like that's basically an auto buy. I can't really see beyond that. And I think that that's basically the TLDR of Liverpool, isn't it? That our interest is basically all about the fullbacks, maybe Van Dijk and Salah for now. I know, for example, that BNM, Matt, is very big on Firmino. Did you know, Nick, that in the second half of last season, so mostly past Bodger being in charge at Leicester, Firmino had a better XG per minute than Vardy and a much better XA per minute than Vardy. The difference was that Firmino played way less as the season wore on. Maybe we'll see next season that the likes of Origi and Firmino are going to be involved with, but I can't really see past them. And we know all of this. You all know all of this. It's all very, very big stuff. Like Salah, especially with Mane finishing the Akon not very long ago, means that Salah's the standout option for game week one. Two Liverpool defenders, whether you choose Van Dijk or choose the two fullback, is basically nailed on for game week one. And basically all we're going to do is hope for that Salah brace. And we're all going to hold each other when Timu Pukki thinks now something could be different. I'm going to score a last-minute consolation to make it 4-1. It's a fitting one to end on, isn't it? Because I think we all know where we stand on that one compared to the rest of the research we've done. And it's just the case of which Liverpool we're going to get. How are we going to buy into the red roulette?
Exactly. I think we're all either going to be suffering or celebrating together on Friday night. We're all likely to be tripled up. Obviously, a few people won't be because they'll be going for differential picks, which is their choice. But I think our strong suggestion is go with Liverpool, and you know their stats really make a big statement there.
Okay, I think that rounds off the first teams. God, how long have we been recording now? A long time. but yeah, that's it. I know you're all individuals. The point of this is to present our analysis, and it's up to you to decide what to do with that data. Remembering the pod we have, Neil Murray, and how you're going to work out how that's applying to your decisions ahead of game week one. point of housekeeping, which is to say thank you very much for those who came along to the meetup 13th of July. I think we have 50 people, didn't we, Nick, in total? Steadily getting drunker and more incoherent throughout the evening. But I stayed sober for hours. It was very interesting to see the disintegration of individuals such as yourself, Nick.
Yeah, it was good fun. Thanks for all those that came to the meeting. It was a really good fun night. And yeah, it's always great to meet the guys in the community and everyone. And yeah, we look forward to doing more meetings. I think we'll probably definitely do one at Christmas as well. So yeah, just to say who we are Who Got The Assist. You can find us on Twitter at WGTA_FPL or myself at WGTA_Nick. You can find us online, whogottheassist.com. As you know, we'll be posting plenty of content throughout the summer, including Tom's value piece. Make sure to like us on Facebook and listen, subscribe to Spotify, SoundCloud, or whatever you'd like. And if you want to join our leagues, the league code for our main league is EIKX03. And our zombie league is EJOS45.
Yep, thank you very much. There's a theme every week. Last week it was Super Mario, and we'll be keeping these on throughout the year. First few pods of the season, it's hard to kind of put them in, but over the course of the year, we'll be doing them more and more. We'll be back next week with the Enter W, yet another epic thing, and I'm guessing that both of us will be putting our notes out as a publishable deliverable after this, because we've done a lot more than you're going to be hearing. But in the meantime, I hope this is you, and we'll speak to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Oh, it's a goal. Who got the assist? Who got the assist?
Sports Social Podcast Network.